There's a story that my colleague Jenny here likes to tell about a woman she heard about in Vogue magazine. And I have to mention it's Jenny, so you know that I don't read Vogue. She was a woman from New York high society, and after a marriage of 25 years fell apart, she got a very lucrative divorce settlement, and people figured she was going to really live it up now, because she was already used to that. And they were pretty shocked when she actually didn't. She went, took all that money she got, went to Rwanda and opened an orphanage there for children whose parents had been killed in the genocide. And Vogue magazine interviewed her, and she was quoted there as saying something that really surprised people. She said, "I'm angry that no one ever told me life could be this good." And she's talking, of course, of life in Rwanda. And that surprised people. We're used to thinking that life doesn't get much better than being rich and having nothing better to do all day than socialize. It's easy to think we have the real thing in life, when in fact, we're all settling for second best. We only have poor substitutes for the life we were actually created for, a life lived close relationship with God. Can do that in all sorts of different ways, but wherever we've come from, whatever life substitute we've been accepting, today we're hoping to kind of lead you over the horizon to see what God really has on offer for you. Before we do that, though, it's always good to remind ourselves where we've been and of the big story, the big Christian story, where God created the world to love and be loved, where we said no thanks. God's been trying to help us come back to him ever since, but we haven't been able to do that. And so God came to us in the person of Jesus and is now inviting us to take his example and improvise in a way that will give this story a good ending. So that's kind of the brief summary of the six-act play that has structured our whole course up to now. And you may hear that story and say, well, that sounds nice enough, but is it actually real? Does it actually have anything to do with my life? Sure, there might be a big story of the whole universe, but could it actually be my story? Does it have anything to do with my story? And we're going to look at how this can be the story of our lives. And you might be wondering how, and so we're going to look first at a story that Jesus told. It was a story he used to tell us how the big story would fit into somebody's life. And he did it in Luke chapter 15. It's a very well-known story. It's called The Prodigal Son. You may think you know it. It kind of goes that, you know, there was a man with two sons. One of them says he'd like his inheritance, so he gets lots of money, goes away, wastes it all on women and booze, and loses big. And he ends up working for other people and and has no food to eat but the pig trough. And so he kind of hits rock bottom, finally decides he's going to head home. And on his way home, his dad comes out to run and meet him, gives him a big hug, welcomes him home, throws him a big party, gives him robes and a ring. And you'd think life would be happy ever after. But there's another brother, too, who stays home. He's the good son, does everything he's told to do, helps run the farm with dad while the other guy goes gallivanting around. And, he's home and then gets upset when his younger brother comes home and has this big party and gets accepted back into the household and says, well, why don't I have the party? Goes out to the barn and sulks about it. And his father has to come out and say, son, you've always been here. But my other son was lost and now he's found. So, yay. That's the story we think we know. It's kind of the surface level understanding of the story. Maybe you've heard it in the Bible. Maybe you've heard people tell it. Maybe you know it from popular culture. It's a pretty well-known story. But we're actually missing the point when we deal with it so superficially. We can get a lot more out of it if we try to listen using the ears of Jesus' first followers, those who lived as Jewish people in the first century AD. They would hear this story in a very different way that gives them a lot more depth. And by trying to put ourselves in their shoes and understand their culture, we can get that too. So the story, as I said, started with the younger son asking his father for inheritance. And we don't really have much to go on there, right? We're not used to the Jewish system of inheritances. But traditionally, the father was expected to not hand out his inheritance until he was nearly dead, the very evening of his life, when he'd give two-thirds to his older son and a third to his younger son. So here's one son coming along saying, I want my third of the inheritance now. Not when you're dead, I want it now. is basically saying to his father, money is more important to me than you. I wish you were dead, but since you're not, can we pretend you are anyway? Give me your money and I'll move on from you. That's essentially the message he's given his father. We miss that, obviously not really understanding the culture, but if we put ourselves in the shoes of his first hearers, we can understand why they'd be outraged, why they would hear this son completely disrespecting and dishonoring his father. They'd be pretty appalled. They'd expect the father to punish him, not to give him the money. And yet that's what happens. They'd be shocked. Then the son doesn't stop there. You know, we think the story's over. You know, he takes the money, runs away, and loses it. But in order to have that money to spend on all these things, he would have had to sell the land, would have had to promise that land to somebody. And that would be an insult to his father as well, because by Jewish tradition, it was stated that in the rare instance where a father divided up his money before dying, the father had to be taken care of. And you would do that by not selling the land. So even if the son owned the land now, he would still have to keep it around in order to make sure father was fed. And so to go and sell the land was an insult to his father. It was not just saying, you know, I wish you were dead, but since you're not, I'm going to take your money, as if you were. But he goes and he sells the land out from under his father. Now, Jewish law, again, said that if that land was sold to somebody else, they then had to keep it around for the father to live off of until the father died. And so he would have sold it at a real bargain, because he's basically selling somebody a promise of land at an unknown date. You're going to have this land when my dad dies, so give me some money now. And you can imagine it's not much money, because this guy is going to sit on this land he can't use until dad dies. The effect of this is that now two people wish dad were dead. The son says, I wish you were dead, to his face. And now there's another guy who wishes dad was dead so he could get the use of the land he just paid for. So now he's sort of doubly insulted, this father. Well, to top it all off, the son goes off to a foreign land. And we miss the point of that. We think, oh, you know, he's going off to Europe backpacking and he's going to find himself. And it's not really what's happening here. For the Jewish people, being Jewish meant being distinct from your neighbors. And there were a lot of laws set up to ensure that they were a distinct people, kind of like Quebec. Different. But there were a lot of rules, and there was a very distinct society known as Judaism. And by going and living among other people, he was kind of dishonoring his Jewishness. His people would have been shocked to hear that, you know. The Jewish people lived in the promised land that God had given them, and they'd gotten there through a lot of hardship and trials. And for him to just go away and leave that and live among other people would have been really surprising to his fellow Jewish people. Like, why would you leave the promised land? Why would you leave what God has given you? Why would you leave your people and your traditions and your ways? And yet he goes and does that. And he lives among other people, wasting all his money until it's gone, and he's forced to work for them. So not only is he living among them, now he works for them. It would have been one thing if he'd gone somewhere else, built a great business, had lots of them working for him, but instead he's working for them. So his people would have been further insulted. And he's working with pigs. And if you know anything about what makes Jews distinct from other people, it's that they don't eat pigs. They don't deal with pigs. They don't touch pigs. And yet here he is working for other people with their pigs. He's gone about as far from his father and his people as possible. He's done everything possible to distance himself from them and their ways. And the original hearers of this story would recognize all that, being Jews themselves, and they would just say, it serves the guy right. He runs out of money. He's dealing with pigs. He brought it upon himself. Too bad. He got what he deserved. That's what they would think. They would probably look to the second son. We look to the second son anyway, and we say, well, he must be the good son. He stayed home, did what he was told. He's the model to follow here. That must be the moral of the story. Be like the older brother who stayed home. But actually, if we listen as Jesus' first followers did, we'll hear that he was actually just as lost as the younger son. In a first century Jewish family, there were very clear social roles. And the role of the older son in a family dispute would be to be the mediator and reconciler. The moment his brother says, "Dad, I wish you were dead, I want your money," his brother should have said, "What? Come here." Taken him out back and said, "What are you doing?" And tried to make things right between the father and the son. That would have been his role clearly delineated in their society. But he doesn't do that. Maybe he had something to gain by keeping quiet. Remember, younger brother gets one third and takes the fall for insulting dad to his face. Older brother gets two thirds. Younger brother still takes the fall. So he doesn't do a thing. Stands back, lets it happen. Gets his double portion, keeps his mouth shut. And then when the younger brother comes home, the older brother starts pouting and says, "Dad, why are you throwing him a party? Why are you doing all these nice things for him? I've been here all along, I've worked hard, I deserve it." To the point that while his father is throwing this massive party to celebrate his son's homecoming, he has to go out and find the older brother and figure out where he is in the first place. I'm sure his guests would have been asking, right? You know, "Hey, I know your younger son's home now, that's why you're having a party. Where's the other guy?" "Well, you see, I don't know." And he has to leave his party, leave his guests, and go find this older brother. And he asks him, "You know, what are you doing?" Invites him back to the party. And then the older brother insults dad to his face too by saying, "You're giving this younger brother all these things that I deserve. I've worked hard for you. I deserve those things. You should be giving them to me." The audience would be awestruck. This guy's got two lousy sons. Two sons who insult him to his face. All right, well, here's your question to explore today. In the story of the two sons that we just told, which of the sons did you relate to most? Were you the one that ran away? Were you the one that stayed close but then realized something later in life was still missing? Which part of the story most engaged you? And why do you think Jesus told this story? So that's your question. Hope you'll share that discussion with some other people you know, from the train or bus, from work, from the neighborhood, somebody else that you can start a bit of a discussion group with to talk about what you're learning in this course. Have a great discussion, and I'll see you tomorrow.